This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to this week's edition of Flashback Friday, which also happens to be a 10th episode. Those of you who subscribe regularly to the podcast know that every 10th episode, Jason goes off topic and brings you something outside of the real estate space that actually affects the real estate space in the long run. Of course, Flashback Friday is your opportunity to get some good review by listening to episodes from the past that Jason has handpicked to help you today in the present and propel you into the future. Enjoy.
Welcome to Creating Wealth with Jason Hartman. During this program, Jason is going to tell you some really exciting things that you probably haven't thought of before, and a new slant on investing. Fresh new approaches to America's best investment that will enable you to create more wealth and happiness than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine, self-made multimillionaire who not only talks the talk, but walks the walk. He's been a successful investor for 20 years and currently owns properties in 11 states and 17 cities. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to financial freedom. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is episode number 490. 490, and you know what that means, listeners. This is a 10th episode show. So we're going to go off topic a little bit and talk about something of general interest. And our guest today will be extreme entrepreneur. That's what he's known as, the extreme entrepreneur, expert in human behavior, world-class speaker, philanthropist, really interesting guy, and that is Peter Sage. So he'll be up in a few moments. But first, I've got Jeremy, who is a really interesting guy here, and we're going to do a show probably on the Holistic Survival Show with him more broadly on some of his interest and content. But he is one of our local market specialists. He helps us with our Memphis and our Little Rock markets. I don't actually want to talk to him too much about real estate today, but we're going to kind of talk on that just for a moment. Hey, are you there? How you doing?
I'm here. I'm doing well, Jason. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to have you on today because I think as a good intro to Peter Sage, you know, we've been talking for a long time. And when you've spoken at our Meet the Masters events and our Creating Wealth events, you know, I always kind of joke about how you're so interested in quantum physics and some of this really fascinating stuff. And I just finished a book, and I think Fernando's really interested in this stuff too, and the listeners have heard him on the show a few times. And he may have recommended this book to me, I can't remember, but it's called Biocentrism. And I tell you, it was fascinating. I was just blown away by some of the things in there. And one of the things, of course, they talk about is the very famous double slit experiment. Tell us about that, if you would, and what does it have to do with anything, really? It's really pretty significant.
Yeah. Well, the double slit goes back to 1803. A man named Thomas Young first performed it, really to answer an age-old question: is light a particle or is it a wave? And basically, the way you do it, it's a pretty simple experiment. You have a plate with two slits in it, and then you shine light through those two slits and observe the pattern that's displayed on a screen on the back end. And if that pattern is basically two bars, then you can conclude that light is a particle. In other words, it's like little globules or photons that come out in discrete points and either go through the left slit or the right slit.
The aha here is, what happened? Did the light act differently whether or not, or the photons, I guess I should say, whether or not it was being observed? I mean, that's mind-boggling, right?
Right. Well, when you shine light through it, you see an interference pattern. So you think light is a wave. Things are done, right? We've come to the answer. Where it gets really interesting is when you fire electrons through, and we think of electrons as being little discrete points of matter like marbles. So we fire individual electrons through the double slit, and we're still seeing an interference pattern, which is kind of weird, because does that mean that the electron is going through both slits at the same time? In other words, making a clone of itself and going through both slits at the same time and then interfering with itself to create an interference pattern. So to answer this question, the scientists decided to put a detector at the double slit to figure out which slit it's going through. However, when they did that, then the interference pattern went away and the electron went back to behaving like a particle. In other words, it passed through either one slit or the other slit as if it was aware that it was being observed. Very, very strange. So,
Yeah, that is just spooky weird.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in the New Age community and in the scientific community, it's kind of odd maybe that these two are really married together in ways. But there's kind of this philosophy that everybody is connected, everything is connected, all matter is one. And, you know, another big part of it, of course, these are giant issues we could take hours to discuss, but, you know, another big part of it is that time is an illusion. It doesn't even exist. Well, what were you going to say there? I just wanted to kind of bring up those big questions for a moment.
Well, as we're developing the double slit, the technology has developed to the point where we can do what are called delayed choice versions of the double slit experiment, where we can fire photons through the double slit and then delay our decision about whether to observe them until after they've passed through the double slit, but before they've been displayed on the back wall. And what we're finding is even when we decide at the last second to observe the electrons after they pass through the double slit, once we open our eyes and take a look, they still behave like particles. And it's as if they went back in time to the point when they left the gun and then decided to behave like particles based on a future decision to be observed. And that's where things get really strange in terms of our perception of time. So breaking this down, you fire electrons through the gun. They pass through the double slit. All this time, the detector is off. Just before they hit the back wall, we turn the detector on, decide to observe them, and then they go from behaving like waves to behaving like particles at the last second, as if they went back in time retroactively and decided to behave like particles from the point that they were fired. And there are actual experiments, including the delayed choice quantum eraser version of the double slit experiment, that confirm this. So bottom line is, it's not anything in the experimental apparatus, in other words, interference with a detector or anything physical, what's causing the particles to behave or the electrons to behave like particles instead of waves is the observer's conscious knowledge of how the apparatus is set up and whether the electrons are going to be observed or not.
So does this tell us that all matter has consciousness? Is that what we're alluding to here?
It seems to imply that. It's almost crazy to even say that. I mean, does an electron have a highly complex computer built into it so that it can look forward in time and base its decision on its nature, waves or particle, based on a future event, whether it's going to be observed or not observed? And then, you know, you can get really crazy with this and scale this up to a cosmic level. I mean, imagine an astronomer on Earth is observing light from a distant object, a quasar that's billions of light years away, and that quasar emits photons that pass by a dense galaxy that gravitationally lenses the photons, and they can either pass one way, the other way, or both ways around the galaxy. So essentially what you have is a double slit on a cosmic scale. And if the astronomer decides to use a two-telescope apparatus, in other words, observing which path the photons pass as they go around the galaxy, then they decide to act like particles retroactively at a point billions of years in the past. Conversely, if he decides to use a screen apparatus and not ascertain which path they pass, then he sees an interference pattern. So that's a mouthful, but it's almost like you could scale this up on a cosmic level and time has no meaning.
You know what's amazing? I mean, look, we've all had experiences in our lives where we've had ESP, where we've experienced, you know, extrasensory perception, okay, or telepathy. We've experienced coincidences that just are almost too crazy to be coincidences, right? And we've all had these experiences at one time or another. We've all had experiences with precognition where maybe in a dream we'll dream something and then it will happen. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about the law of attraction. And years ago, I got really interested in something called holographic brain theory. And really, I got interested in it as a way to achieve goals, as a goal-achieving mechanism. So suffice it to say a couple of things. Number one, it's an amazing time to be alive. It's an amazing time to be alive, okay? Number one. But number two, in 5 or 10 years, because the technology is increasing so exponentially right now, and it always has, but especially now, that we're going to look back, and this is just 5 or 10 short years. This is not far into the future, in my opinion. We're going to look back and think, well, of course this was this way. We didn't understand it at the time, but it'll seem so obvious in the future. We'll act like, well, yeah, of course. Like, why didn't we understand that? which are the things we don't understand today. Yet, look at how things have amazed us in the past technologically. So, it is really, really incredible. So, yeah, thanks for talking about some of this stuff. What, if anything, does it have to do with investing in Memphis or Little Rock? that segue.
Well, I'm driven by intellectual curiosity. Real estate is a great business. It's a means to an end for me in terms of building wealth and generating income. But the bigger picture is we all have things that we're very passionate about. And, I think beyond real estate, business, and entrepreneurship, each of us needs to know what drives us. For me personally, science, astronomy, and just in general, intellectual curiosity is the fuel that drives me each day. So
if any of our investors listening buy a property from you in one of your markets, will you give them a free double slit experiment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you buy a property from me, I will give you a breakdown of the double slit in all its glory, from Thomas's version in 1803 to the quantum eraser version in 2007. You got it all, baby.
Awesome. What a deal. See, now, that is a direct response hook. That's what internet marketers would call it, right?
Exactly.
I bet you haven't heard that, folks, on any other show. Usually it's a free report on Jason's 10 Commandments of Successful Investing or something like that. But here we know our listeners are at a much higher level, so we want to appeal to their higher intellect. So that's great.
Hey, Jason, it's not just quantum physics. If they want to hear a talk on dark energy, dark matter, or the Carrington event, I've got all that too, buddy.
What's the Carrington event?
The Carrington event occurred in 1859. And it's an extreme solar storm. In fact, it was a perfect solar storm that had a significant global footprint. Now, at that time, there was no technology other than the telegraph. And telegraph operators actually experienced sparks flying from their telegraphs and being electrocuted, in some cases starting fires, because of this extreme solar storm. The catch is, if a Carrington-level event geomagnetic storm were to occur today, it would destroy the power grid, and the fallout would be as much as 1/3 to 1/2 of the population of the civilized world could die off over a period of 5 to 10 years as a result.
Yeah, I've talked about that. Basically, an EMP,
that's right,
taking down the power grid and putting us back into the Stone Age. We've done several shows on that on the Holistic Survival show. That is a scary, fascinating concept. And I'll tell you, folks, it's not weird or silly to just be responsible and have some basic preparedness. No one here on my show is saying, on the Holistic Survival show, a couple people are saying it, but go live in the woods with a shotgun and a can of beans. That doesn't sound like much fun, but it's just responsible to have some basic preparedness. I mean, you can do this for $200 per person in your household. It just makes sense. I mean, this is just not, this is just prudent and smart. And it would take a long time, they say, to bring the power grid back up, to replace all those transformers and stuff like that. So either solar storm or a weaponized version with an EMP blast, an EMP-type bomb, electromagnetic pulse is what that means, by the way. Fascinating stuff. But in our daily lives in investing, let's just bring this back around and then get to Peter Sage. What's going on in the Memphis market and the Little Rock market? Our Arkansas, in Little Rock, is our only market in Arkansas, but that is the most landlord-friendly state in the country. We've had lots of investors going in there since we opened it, almost 8 months ago, I want to say.
Yeah, we're coming up on the better part of a year now since we launched Little Rock, and it's an exciting market to be in, a linear market similar to Memphis. Like you said, it's the most landlord-friendly state in the country. If a tenant is even one day late paying their rent, the landlord can start the eviction process. And if they don't vacate within a certain period of time, having not paid rent, it's a crime. They can literally be arrested, fingerprinted, mugshot, and in some cases put in jail. So
wow.
Only state in the union where that can happen.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, you know, not that you'd even want to do that as a landlord. I don't think I would, unless I just had a tenant that was quite literally a criminal. Right. The thing is, the fact that they know that possibility exists, it just gets them to behave in a whole different way.
That's exactly right.
So, yeah. How is the market there, and how is the market in Memphis? We're working on an upcoming Memphis tour. You know, that's why I wanted to have you on today, a property tour, distressed property tour. Yeah,
the Memphis market is strong, and it's getting stronger by the day. You know, the fundamentals are obviously still there in terms of the percentage of the population that rents over 50%. So you have a high tenant pool. Obviously, with FedEx here, AutoZone, International Paint, Paper, St. Jude, you got a strong core of jobs that are really driving Memphis. In sports, the Memphis Grizzlies are a contender this year. So if you're into professional sports like I am, that's a great thing. But the biggest thing is the numbers. I mean, you still can get a property here at a price and at a rent rate that is well above the 1% rule and gives you those fundamentals in terms of cash flow. So, and I'll tell you, you know, we've got a lot of competition. You know, hedge funds have come in here. We still have other turnkey providers here. So I think the biggest indicator for us, unfortunately, is that we have to fight every day to continue to acquire new inventory, which is both good and bad. It's bad in a sense because we would love to have a, you know, a steady stream of properties, but it's good in that it tells you that stuff is not staying on the market very long. It's getting snatched up and, you know, people are buying, both retail and investors.
Mm-hmm. So give us like a sample property in each of those markets. Which one is more expensive? Is Little Rock more expensive than Memphis?
They're about the same. I would say they're comparable. In terms of, you know, an example property, we just finished up a property on 17 Berkshire in Little Rock that we actually put under contract yesterday. And, you know, this is a three bedroom, two bathroom house, 1200 square feet. Rents for about $1,000 a month, and you know, we sold it for $95. So that's one example of a property in Little Rock. And then in Memphis, we've got a couple properties that we're wrapping up. We got one on Seminary Cove, and 3101 Seminary Cove. This one will sell for about $109,000, and it rents for $1,150 a month. Fantastic property. It's brick. It's four bedrooms, three bathrooms, huge kitchen, huge den with a fireplace. You know, property that you would envision living in yourself if it was a, you know, retail property. So, you know, 2,000 square feet. So those are the kinds of properties that we're doing. Stuff that sells between 95 and let's say 120,000. It'll rent anywhere from 1,000 to 1,200 a month and, you know, just throw off some really great cash flow.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, thank you so much for joining us and talking about some of this interesting scientific stuff. It's quite fascinating. We'll get you on the Holistic Survival Show and do a whole show about it.
That sounds great.
Sometime. So let's do that. And folks, go to jasonhartman.com. Take a look at properties in Memphis, in Little Rock. I'd say in Memphis, we're coming up on way over 100 transactions. We're probably close to 200 transactions in Memphis so far. I'm just guessing. So we've done a lot of business there. Little Rock, of course, great too, doing a lot of business there as well. So there's some good properties, great rent-to-value ratios, landlord-friendly markets. Go to jasonhartman.com, click on the properties section, and check them out. And let's go to our guest today, Peter Sage. And again, this is a 10th show, so, you know, we'll talk a lot more in-depth about real estate on non-10th shows. We just kind of go off topic every show that ends in a zero. We discuss something of general interest. We know we have a multidimensional audience, and this is why we do that. So our next show will be very focused on real estate investing and personal finance and economics and all that good stuff, okay? Let's get to our guest, Peter Sage. It's my pleasure to welcome Peter Sage to the show. You've probably heard his name. He is the founder of Space Energy, former chairman of London Yes Group, and member of the Entrepreneurship Advisory Board for INSEED. And he has had many businesses, many adventures, and is just an all-around very, very interesting guy. And I've also got a co-host who actually recommended him to the show today, and that is our client, Fernando. So welcome to both of you. And Peter, what are you up to nowadays?
Great question. And first, thank you for the invite and for the opportunity to be able to share. And that's really ties in with the answer to the question, because right now most of my focus is really on about being able to take a lot of the lessons that I've learned as a serial entrepreneur for the last 25 years and with a passion in personal development and understanding human behavior, and bring that to a wider level of awareness to hopefully help people either get through some of the frustrations that seem to be so prevalent in today's society, or you know, help them get through to the next level that they've been trying to get to, with maybe some shortcuts through some of the mistakes I've made or some of the lessons I can help people along the way with. So that's really where my core focus is right now, is on sharing my message.
Remember, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and Wednesday. Well, one of the things I really like about your work is that if you're talking to entrepreneurs about how to manage their mind, if you will, and you know, manage their psychology, that's so important. And most of the speakers and gurus out there that are doing this, they just have had one business, their own info marketing business, right? But you really are a serial entrepreneur. I mean, how many companies have you been involved in?
I actually lost count. I think it's 22 or 23, somewhere on there, that I've started. Actually, I started all of them apart from one which I bought. And so the rest have been all startups. I'm a startup guy. Yeah. And some of them have been, you know, greatly successful international, you know, household names. Some have been, you know, dramatic failures that have wiped me out. You know, some probably should have stayed ideas when I was drunk. And pretty much everything in between. So I've had a huge sort of array of experience in different industries. You know, I don't have a trade as such. My trade is business, and that's really what I think's helped me understand a lot of the different aspects. Because when you come talk about helping business owners, you know, I coach at high level, and almost every single time people come to me and say, "I've got a problem with the business. I need to hire a top business coach," and almost every single time I will pin it back to an issue with the psychology of the business owner, not the business itself. Yeah, it's always endemic to the psychology of the business owner. You clear up that and the business takes care of itself. I mean, there's certain strategies and specifics sometimes that are required in terms of an issue in the business, if it is a certain marketing aspect they're looking for. But 9 times out of 10, the systemic problems in the business have nothing to do with the business. They have everything to do with the mindset of the business owner.
I would agree. That makes a lot of sense. Tell us about some of the businesses. You said some were very successful household name type companies. Maybe just give us a little bit of a primer, a sampling, if you would.
Certainly. I mean, my first business was selling toys on flea markets, would you believe, at 17 years old. I was Pete the Toy Boy.
Yeah, and I watched your video about that. That was great.
and yet then I did a self-publishing business. I had a casting agency. I was one of the first people in the 95 to actually pioneer database casting instead of filing cabinet type casting. That went very well. I had a nutrition company, nutraceutical company, anti-aging company called the Worldwide Health Corporation. And that was a big success. I sold that in 2005, I believe, just got resold a couple of years ago. I built a very large chain of health clubs and fitness centers called Energy Health and Fitness. And in fact, we just opened our 100th club last year. I'm very proud of them. It's a good legacy. I sold out of that a little while back. And yeah, I've had ideas where, you know, I did a CNN news set, and which I had a replica news set and was traveling around the country doing newscastings for different areas that was tying into the casting agency. That was a dramatic failure. I think the negativity of the news actually helped the demise of the business. But I've had other business ideas that I've tried and swung the bat at. Land development was very successful. I had a property refurbishment company that was very successful. And sometimes I'll stop a business because I'm no longer passionate. Yeah, it's the business is okay, but I'm bored. If I'm bored, what am I doing it for? Yeah, you know, it's not about accumulating anything. It's about expressing passion. And so if you're not doing that anymore, then you're working off the wrong metric.
Peter, I first heard of you listening to the Bulletproof Executive podcast with Dave Asprey.
Yeah.
And I just loved your message. I resonated strongly with the podcast. And I actually had my wife listened to it, and then my kids had to listen to it.
Oh, oh dear.
So
now they hate me.
I really liked it. I do have a question or several questions related to that. If you could expand on some of the concepts.
Of course.
One of them that I really try to expose to my kids is the concept of the emotional IQ and the financial IQ, and how you actually apply and use those concepts to your, you know, your bank accounts, and use an analogy for how bank accounts work. So can you expand on that a little bit?
Certainly. And for the listeners here that may not have had the opportunity to listen to the Bulletproof podcast, I'll give a little bit of context. What I say to people a lot when I'm working with them, or what a lot of my observations are, is that most people, whether it's in life, in careers, in business, are usually chasing money. Yeah, most people are chasing money because they're under the illusion that by getting more money, it'll solve their problems. Now, I say the illusion because most people believe that, because most of people who don't have money, their immediate problems are usually associated or attributed to lack of money. You know, they're trying to pay the rent on Friday, or, you know, make the payments on the car. So they think that money will get rid of those problems because they're, you know, they're immediately connected. Whereas obviously, you know, everybody who's been down that path knows it's not true. You know, money doesn't solve problems at any level. In fact, money creates a whole different set of problems. But if you're chasing money, and we're coming to the end of the year here on this particular day on the recording, it'll probably go out in the new year. But in terms of the start of the year, 2015, there's a lot of people making New Year's resolutions. A lot of people want 2015 to be different to 2014. Yeah. And unfortunately, the challenge there is that most people, you know, going out to make 2015 different are looking for a better career. They're looking for a promotion at work. They're looking for a new business or a new business opportunity. What they're not doing is changing themselves to become a person of higher value, because we have an emotional bank account and we have a financial bank account. And the challenge is that most people's emotional bank account usually follows their financial bank account. You know, you've got no money at the end of the month, and your emotional bank account is low. And, you know, you suddenly get paid and your emotional bank account goes up. The challenge with that is that it's the wrong way around. We need to raise our emotional bank account first and become a person of value in order for the financial bank account to be increased. And the reason for that is because money is simply a byproduct or a consequence of adding value to someone or something else. Yeah, it's just an arbitrary medium of exchange. Most people don't understand that the only place in the universe that money means anything is in the mind of man. Nothing else keeps track of it. It's a conceptual fabrication that has allowed us to value or correlate different levels of exchange. So if you are going to receive any money, it's always because you've given something for it of value first. You never want unearned income. So from that perspective, if you haven't increased your own sense of self-worth and you're going out trying to earn more money, it's almost futile. You're chasing your tail. So when I talk about a financial IQ and or a financial bank account and emotional bank account, then most people are running out with a low financial bank account, i.e. low self-worth, trying to get money. And it's like sitting in front of the fire saying, you know, I'm cold, please give me some heat and then I'll go fetch you some wood. It doesn't work that way. So if you can understand that money is nothing more than a byproduct or a consequence of the value that you add, you can stop chasing it and start asking yourself the question, how can I become a person of value? And that's where you start focusing on investing in yourself and focusing on how can you contribute more to somebody that's worth something to them, rather than running around with the handout thinking, how can I scratch a deal together to make a few bucks? Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense. I remember Earl Nightingale telling me, you know, it's age 17, that example of don't be in front of the empty fireplace and say, give me heat and then I'll give you wood. But I think the challenge for people is that this is kind of amorphous, you know, it's not a develop yourself. Great advice, obviously. And, you know, give value first, don't have unearned income. But I think a lot of people have struggled with the lack of specificity with that. Do you have any advice for them?
Get in touch with what it is you're passionate about. Yeah, you're not going to be a person of value if you're walking around resenting what it is that you're doing, or you're doing it just in order to get a means to an end to get some money. Now, you know, it's hard to turn around, you know, and what I'm not saying here is go give up your job and follow your dream. I mean, that's just Disneyland thinking. That's going to put more pressure on people that can't handle that level of uncertainty. So, but if you have an excuse that says, I'm not going to focus on what it is that I actually want my life to be about because I'm too busy, you know, chasing, you know, my tail, trying to earn a living, then you're never going to get out of that quicksand. If you, instead of saying, listen, right now, these are the cards I've been dealt with. I'm in a job that I don't really like. Yeah, I'm struggling to for a lifestyle I can't really afford, but I'm not going to give up the level of vision that I have for what it is that I want my life to be about. I'm going to start broadcasting at a level of what it is that I want, not what it is that I don't want, and start shifting from that particular place. That's practical. People can start doing it now, yeah, not tomorrow. But most people have forgotten to get in touch with the sense of what it is that they want because they're too busy focused on avoiding what they don't want. Hence, they attract more of it. Yeah, so what is it you're good at? What is it that lights you up? If you were to ask your best friend, yeah, and say, hey, listen, yeah, what am I good at? Yeah, what am I known for? Yeah, it could be that you have a certain way with being able to communicate to people and mediate. Yeah, in which case, you know, you've got a whole different angle there of avenues to explore. It could be that you're the opposite of that. You're actually very direct with people, and yeah, there's a whole different aspect. You know, one's more political, one's more, you know, direct selling. Yeah, there's a whole different way of, you know, are you good with children? Are you more of a loner? Are you good at figuring out problems? Are you good with numbers? Are you good with, yeah, there's so many things that we have inherent predispositions towards that most of us suppress because we're too busy settling for something that's going to put a buck on the table. And so, yeah, focus on, you know, what are the gifts that I've got? Do an inventory of the gifts that you have. The problem most people is they have such a low sense of self-esteem when they look in the mirror because they attach their self-worth to their net worth. And if their net worth is, you know, is always a moving target, yeah, the self-worth is never going to be off the table. Yeah, it's never going to be off the floor. Yeah, you are not your bank account. You never have been. You know, you never will be. But if we start making that fundamental error, we're going to be walking around like a walking crap magnet, yeah, attracting stuff that is never going to serve our true purpose. Yeah, when was the last time you sat down and asked yourself better questions? Yeah, what am I passionate about? Yeah, what if I could only spend my life doing one thing, what would it be? Start just exploring possibility rather than settling for the fact that, you know, this is what I'm going to get because it's all the economy is where it is. Yeah, it's, you know, I can give specificity, but obviously, you know, we're talking 300 million people in the US. Yeah, it needs to have some level of universal component to apply. But people need to come from a place of that nobody has the right to tell you can't do it. Yeah, if you're coming from a place of what is it that I'm here to do, it's certainly not to work in a job that I don't like for 40 years to retire and be forgotten.
And I think this concept starts early in people's lives. You know, this is not taught in school. I think it's probably, I would argue that the opposite is taught in school, where, you know, you're following a pattern and you get stuck into that pattern, and that's pretty much what takes all your thinking. You don't take the time to stop and reevaluate things at a very deep level. And I know you have some thoughts about how this can be taught earlier in life, and I would ask you how can kids get the understanding of how important it is to know you know what they're passionate about and not get lost in the academics, spending so much time in trying to do repetitive work in school just to achieve a certain grade and move on from there on this repetitive motion and never get out of it?
Great question. And the answer certainly isn't going to come in the mainstream from traditional education. You know, we all know that school is fundamentally geared towards teaching people how to pass tests and work for somebody else. And yeah, it's always left for the people to have their own spark of interest to go and follow that, and those flames aren't usually fanned from the academic, you know, system as it stands today. It's more geared to drill process and conformity than it is celebrate individual uniqueness. So it really comes back to the parents. And the challenge is most kids these days, you know, don't come with an owner's manual. Yeah, when parents have a baby, you know, there's more instructions with their DVD player than, you know, they walk out of Sears with than when they walk out of the hospital. So, yeah, so everybody's trying to figure it out. And yeah, we're all just grown-up kids at the end of the day. So as a parent still dealing with their own stuff, one of the things I would recommend is, look, one of the best things you can give your child is a level of self-esteem. And you get self-esteem just, you know, very similar to how you train a dog. You know, you train a dog for, yeah, excuse the parallel, but you train a dog by positive reinforcement. Yeah, not by making it cower in the corner every time it does something wrong. And you know, for kids to be praised and to have any negativity reframed in a way that serves the lesson or serves or leads to a better or a higher level of looking at it is what the parents would, in my opinion, would do better to do rather than tear down the child because they got a B instead of an A. Yeah, all the kids are looking for is approval, recognition, love, connection, validation. And if you can find a way of giving them that, you know, if they get a D, celebrate it wasn't an E. Encourage them to be better so that next time it's a C or a B. You know, and start putting that level of spin. You will build their level of self-esteem rather than put pressure on them to think they have to earn the right to be loved, approved, or validated. You know, if they can be conditioned to find that from a place of knowing that they're already good enough, then you're really going to start giving them permission to find what their passion is rather than feel judged for going to do it or feel silly or trapped that the fact it won't be approved of at whatever level of approval they seek.
Peter, I know that you have an incredible story. You dropped out of school when you were 16. You started your first company at 17. How did this idea of trying to prove yourself and having maybe difficulties with self-esteem play the role when you were that young? You know, what was going through your mind, and what advice do you have for people that are maybe that age?
For me, it was all in retrospect, because at the time you don't see it. You know, I didn't see the patterns I was running until long after the fact. And for me, it was really a case of my parents, you know, we were hardworking. You know, we lived on in sort of council accommodation, and they saved up enough to try and get me into a private school, which was quite against the norm in the neighborhood that I was in. And when I was 10 years old, I actually, my mom sat me down and said, look, we can't afford to keep you in the private school. You're going to go to the state school system, which is a bit of a lottery when it comes to, you know, how well you're going to do, at least in a private school. Yeah, just like if you're going to, you know, Cornell or Harvard or Stanford, wherever, you'd expect a good education because it's forced upon you in a way. The system supports that. Whereas in the traditional education, it's usually a coin flip. The teachers are there focused on getting you through the system to graduate, not on expressing and bringing the best out of you. So, for me, my parents got into a situation whereby they were worried that they'd just lost the guaranteed university place for their child. And so I was conditioned at the age of 10 years old in the summer holidays between the two schools, that transition. Yeah, my mom and dad were like, listen, if you don't work hard, you'll probably end up emptying the garbage of the people you were just at school with. You know, if you don't work hard now, the teachers aren't going to push you. You won't go to university. You won't get a car. All this stuff, and it scared the bejesus out of me. It really did. But in that moment, an overachiever was born. But it was born out of fear. It was born out of, I have to do this, otherwise I'll sleep on a park bench in winter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for me, the two-edged sword was I felt that I had to prove something. You know, I developed an unconscious, consistent question of how can I achieve more, because that was the route to validate myself for my parents. And everything I did from 10 years old, I excelled at. Was I happy? No, not at all, because as soon as I'd achieved something, I'm asking the question again, how can I achieve more? It was always raising the bar. So yeah, I didn't see that until I looked back in my sort of later 20s when I was doing a lot of deep work around uncovering the patterns that we run as kids and as adults. And for me, it was a case of, if I'd have known I was good enough at the time, I may not have achieved as much. You know, I was a millionaire at 22, and all this business success, absolutely stressed out of my brains and miserable as hell. I was an idiot to work for. Nobody liked me, but I was achieving because I felt that was the path. Whereas, if you can turn around and and show somebody that they're already good enough, and now they're free to go and do what it is they want because it's something that they are passionate about, not because it's something they need to prove themselves. And parents need to be careful when they say, it could be an offhand comment. Yeah, if daddy says you're not good enough, yeah, you're going to take that with you for a long time. Yeah, you've got parents that have chosen the careers for their kids, yeah, and you see this in many different cultures in advance. Yeah, you get people that trying to prove their worth to their parents that are in careers 20, 30, 40 years later that they just don't enjoy. It's a travesty of freedom of individuality. So, you know, if you want to chunk it down, most of the patterns that I see that are limiting patterns that people run, whether it's in business or life, come from the place where we perceive we either did or didn't get love from the place we most wanted it from as a kid. Yeah, and if we still carry those patterns around, then chances are it's going to be affecting us right now unconsciously, even if we're 65 years old.
Yeah, it sure is. Peter, just a very kind of general question of the ages for you. So there's a lot of latitude on this one. But can people change? I mean, why is it that some people struggle, and some people just seem to improve themselves, change themselves, you know, to what the world wants so they can get what they want and achieve great goals and live happily ever after? How's that for a general question?
And see if I can understand the question. Are you saying, why is it some people do that and why do some people struggle to change?
People who are struggling will generally say that they want to have success, they want to achieve things, they want to make a difference, they want to contribute more. You know, they just can't seem to get themselves to do it, I guess, for reasons unknown, at least to me. Whereas some can just do it. I mean, is it that simple? Just do it, Nike, you know? Do we go back to that, or is there a lot more under the surface than that?
I was going to say, on the surface, yes. Underneath the surface, there's always a lot more. Yeah, and that comes from the patterns that we're running, again, usually linked to self-esteem. And also the fact that you've got two different aspects here that are very rarely discussed. You've got strategies and skill sets. Yeah, if it's just a case of, you know, I've got the want to, I've got the desire, but I just don't have the how to. You know, if I want to see a sunset and my strategy is to run east, it's not going to happen. Yeah, no matter how badly I want it. But yeah, you've got the strategy side, but then you've also got another side that's rarely talked about, and that is levels of awareness, yeah, levels of consciousness, you know, whatever language you want to put on. I don't want to get too esoteric here. I want to keep it real. But you will usually have people that stop growing emotionally round about teenagers and then play the same patterns for a long time to come. So yeah, if you've got, for example, a situation where you have, and see if you can bear with me on the example here, it's quite powerful. If you take a glass of water and if you fill that water with something, that the stuff inside that glass, yeah, if you imagine that, a glass half full of water. If you imagine the stuff inside the glass is the stuff of your life. It's the content of your life. It's your job, your career, your family, your money, your no money, your religion, your hobbies, your whatever. It's the stuff. It's the story. It's all the stuff. The glass that holds the stuff of our life is the context. So we have the content and we have the context. Now, what most people do in life, when they're not happy with the content of their life, because they're always trying to change it. So they're always trying to stir the stuff of their life. And in their 20s, they're stirring it like mad. In their 30s, there's a little more of a pattern to it. We're kind of falling into the same routines. 40s and 50s, you know, we're still stirring. And, you know, we're saying, you know, I don't like this clear stuff in the glass. I want blue. You know, I'm sick of this transparent level of clear. It's all boring.
Changing the content again. Yeah.
Yeah, I want blue. I'm going to hang out with blue people. I'm going to drive a blue car, eat blue food, get a blue job. Yeah. Watch blue films, whatever. You know, it's all about changing what they have. And the challenge is you see other people that don't have that stuff going on, but instead of changing the content, they shift the color of the glass. Now, if you were to change the color of the glass, how you hold the content of your life to blue, instantly everything that was in your life would appear to look blue. But you didn't change anything. You changed the way you held it. And what causes people to change the way they hold stuff usually is a significant emotional event. either they hit rock bottom, and or their spouse leaves them, or they get fired, or they lose something that's precious and realize that it's more than money to life. Whatever it is, if you get a significant emotional event, it could be a health issue, it could be a near death experience, whatever it is, and all of a sudden nothing about the content of their life changes. But everything about the context changes, and then, of course, everything in their life changes as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I love the context-content example. It's kind of that old thing of, fish, they live in water, but they don't see the water. And so we have this sort of, the context is kind of invisible to most people. But and what you said was very true about an event. It will usually cause that big shift rather than rearranging the furniture in the living room or changing the color of the liquid in the glass concept. But, does that have to be, I guess maybe the trick is, and maybe you're going to lead us right to this, Peter, and it's brilliant the way you're doing it, is that we have to be able to at will change that context without suffering, hopefully, from some big negative event like a terrible crisis, our significant other leaving us, a near-death experience, whatever it is, to shift that at will so that we can make transformational change. How do we do that? How do we change that context without going through a real low?
Well, there's two ways. One way, which I just said, a significant emotional event is usually where you link massive pain to your existing condition to the point where you hit threshold and want to change. That's usually what happens when you don't listen to the signs for long enough, whether it's a mini heart attack, because you've been eating too many Cheerios, or whether it's something else. But there's usually enough signs en route. Whether it's that gut feeling that says you shouldn't really be doing business with these people or whatever it is. So that's the pain side. The way to shortcut that is to go for the pleasure side. And that comes back to what we mentioned right at the beginning, which is passion. If you can ask yourself, if you can stop sleeping awake, if you can wake up from the hypnosis that most people are in, where they're walking around as a giant reaction machine to life rather than a proactive, engaging machine to life, then you're going to start being able to tap into that level of spirit that causes you to go out and be the person you want to be. Now, you don't have to wait for a heart attack before you put down the Pringles. You can get inspired by tapping into that level of passion. So ask yourself the question, what's most important to you in life? Is it being able to see your grandkids get married? In which case, carrying on smoking 20 cigarettes a day is probably not going to get you there. But if you're not focused on what it is that you really want at a level that means more to you than appearances and surface level of keeping up with the Joneses, then you're not going to tap into that level of truth that's inside that compels you to put down the cigarettes. And so, it's about being able to tap out of passion. Now, here's the insight I want to lead people to. If you want to chunk it simple, we have two predominant centers in the body. We have a thinking center, which most people would usually assume is somewhere in the mind or the head. But we also have a feeling center, which is, call it the heart, the soul, the gut, doesn't matter. Most people will justify all of the stuff with the thinking center. And the reason for that is the thinking center has access to a whole range of different tools because it communicates in language, reasoning, deduction, logic, association, metaphor, label. It has access to a huge range of tools. Now, the feeling center communicates in a very different language. It only knows two things. Yes, no. Feels good, doesn't feel good. Move towards, move away from. Occasionally, it can be neutral as well. But generally speaking, our instinct, our gut feel, our sixth sense, our soul, our heart will tell us 9 times out of 10 the right thing to do, but then the mind kicks in. And if the mind is sat across the table from the heart, the mind will usually win, not because it's right, far from it, but because it has access to way more tools in the debating class than the heart does. So therefore, if you want to tap into passion, if you want to move forward with congruency, there has to be alignment of the heart and mind. There has to be alignment of the thinking center and the feeling center. From that place, you'll go and create change that will last. But most people have only alignment with one of those. And it's either the heart says, something, I really want to do this. I really feel that I could start my own business. I really feel that, I'd be great working with kids. but there's no agreement with the mind because the mind kicks in and says, something, you don't have the qualifications, or what if this happens, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, your mom's always right saying that you should just settle down for the job and get what you get at the end of the week. So we sell out. Or the other way around. Yet the mind says, you know, I've been to a positive development seminar. I'm going to do this. I'm going to change. I'm sick of this. And yeah, that's it. I'm going to sit in front of the mirror and say, I am a millionaire in waiting. And the heart says, you know something? Not feeling it. Yeah, you got rent to pay on Friday. I don't see the self-esteem reflected back. And so you have this disparity between the two. The challenge is what unites the heart and the mind faster than anything else is fear. Because we know exactly what we don't want and we feel it. So what we usually broadcast as a signal, we're walking around vibrating with total congruency about what we don't want. Is it any wonder that's what we attract and keep perpetuating? If we can say, no, I want to start attracting the right kind of stuff in my life. I want to get on a track where I don't want to have a heart attack to push me over the edge. Get alignment with the heart and mind about what it is you do want and start moving your feet. From that place, you can create change that lasts.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and every Wednesday. Okay, so we should be in fear in order to get alignment?
No, absolutely not. If
because we're going to attract what we don't want, right?
What you don't want. What I'm saying is that the challenge, most people use the machine effectively in reverse. Yeah, you will move towards congruently what it is that you're in alignment with the heart and mind. Now, it doesn't care if that's what you don't want or whether it's what you do want. Just like gravity doesn't care if you're a good guy or a bad guy. You step off a building, you're going down. So, but most people unconscious of that will inadvertently broadcast, you know, or have complete congruency with the thinking and feeling center about what they don't want. Yeah. Because that's what aligns it faster, rather than say, whoa, let me consciously now align what it is that I do want and start moving forward to make the machine work in my favor.
Okay, I like what you said about making the person doing the affirmations, right? You use that example of, you know, I'm a millionaire, and it just doesn't work because the heart doesn't believe it, right? And so that doesn't work. So how do we move that needle and make that belief, you know, in the congruency with the heart and the mind, which is what you're talking about. Any more examples of that? Because I think that's just a wonderful way to put it.
So certainly. The challenge that puts the parameters around this, the border or the barrier to which we change is usually our comfort zone. Now, the thing with a comfort zone is that, you know, if people knew what it was, they'd be very keen to get out of it. But yeah, it's so limiting to our potential. But we get into this habitual level of living inside a comfort zone through fear of what may be outside of it. Now, if we suddenly, you know, have this revelation, no, that's it, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, I'm going to move forward. If we start trying to move too far outside of that, let's say the mind takes a flag and plants it in the sand, you know, 200 yards outside of our comfort zone, says, I'm a millionaire, the heart's not buying in. But if you want to get buy-in, yeah, place it just outside. If I'm used to earning, yeah, $80,000 a year, then let's stick it to $100,000. You know, that's within the, I can stretch that and get buy-in. I'm okay. So take smaller steps and build up habitually to start getting out of the comfort zone you're currently in.
Because that's believable to the heart or the subconscious.
Exactly.
Maybe you want to say it that way too. So that's a believable thing. But then, Peter, what do we make of these people that have not done incremental things? I mean, they've done exponential things. How do they do that?
Again, they have a big enough why. Yeah, your heart will buy into the why. Yeah, the mind won't justify. See, for me, when I set goals, yeah, I set goals from a very different place. I don't set traditional goals of trying to improve myself incrementally. You know, I have two organizing principles and distinctions when it comes to goals. The first one is this. If I have any idea how I can achieve the goals I set, they're too small. Yeah, the how is none of my business.
Love it. Love it. That's good. So if you can plan that out and draw a mind map or a flow chart as to the how, then the goal is too small.
Absolutely. Why are you setting yourself up to do something you know how to do? Where's the room for growth? Yeah, where's the room for magic? But it also ties in with the second principle, which is the real purpose of setting a goal, on my perspective, is not to achieve the goal. So if you're setting goals to achieve them, it's because you think you're not enough with the goal, with not having what you think it is the goal represents. So therefore, you're coming from a place of lack. For me, if you go to nature, look at the two rules that nature operates by. It operates by growth and contribution. Anything that doesn't grow and contribute is taken out of the food chain. We just think we're different because we're too egocentric half the time. But if you come from a place of saying, well, you know something? For me, it's not about achieving the goal. That's not the purpose of setting a goal. The purpose of setting a goal is to see who do I need to become in order to achieve the goal. Then if I miss it by 3 degrees, I'm not going to beat myself up if it means I've already grown another 10.
Zig Ziglar said a great thing like about that. He said, you know, it's not what we get by reaching our goals that counts. It's who we become by trying. I've always loved that quote.
Every time. I'll give you one other metaphor I think people will relate to. Yeah, and this is that imagine, for example, that you'd entered a competition 3 months ago. You were bored in a line. You picked up a leaflet. You filled out this, and it was a competition for a round-the-world trip. And you filled it in, you dropped it in the entry box, you forgot all about it. Anyway, you get home, there's a voicemail saying you've won the trip. And it's an incredible round-the-world trip, 20 destinations, all on your bucket list. You know, you're talking Machu Picchu, the pyramids, Northern Lights. I mean, all of these amazing things, first-class Learjet, cruise ship, 5-star hotels, you get the deal. Yeah, 3 6-month trip. It's like a lifetime. You can take two people with you. It's just off the charts. You're so excited. Just put yourself there for a second and get in that frame. And we do what we do as human beings when we experience a level of emotion, happy or sad, is we want to share it. So we pick up the phone to our best friend and we say, hey, guess what? You're not going to believe what's happened. I've won this amazing trip. I've checked it out. It's all real. It's all booked. The tickets are on the way. I leave in 2 weeks. Unbelievable. Yeah, I've got all these destinations we're going to go. And before you say anything else, they cut you off. They say, well, hang on a minute. Well, what's your final destination? Where do you end up? And you're like, well, hang on a minute. I don't know. But let me tell you about the trip. We're going to all these places. And, no, I don't care about them. Well, where do you finish? And you're like, well, I don't really care. I've not looked that far ahead. I just want to enjoy the trip. That's life. For most people, that's life. They're so busy, focused on the end destination, they completely miss the fact that this life's a trip. And as a result of that, we get upset about all the different places we go because we're ignoring the magic in it. Yeah, the goal isn't about where you're ending up. The goal is about who do I need to become as a result of this that can compel me to become more of who I am and the best version of me possible. Otherwise, why am I here?
Yeah, great question.
Yeah, I know, as I said earlier, it's certainly not to spend 40 years of my life working 9 to 5 in a job for somebody who doesn't care enough about me other than give me wages that I probably never met, that so I can get to the end and get a watch and wonder what happened.
Right, yeah. And that's unfortunately what so many have done with their lives. Peter, and Fernando, please jump in here any moment. I don't want to dominate the conversation. But Peter, I do have one question. Just, I really enjoyed Simon Sinek's book on, Start With Why and his corresponding TED Talk, as I bet you do too. I just have a feeling you like that. You know, developing that why, do you have any more advice on how to find the why, or is the why created? Is it something we manufacture for ourselves, or is it something we find? I ask myself that. I sort of struggle with why. In the financial world, I don't need any more money, but it's kind of a nice challenge, and there are things you can do with money. So it's not a need thing. It's got to be a why thing. What can I do? What can I contribute? What influence can I have with it, right?
You absolutely. You come back to, I think it was 2007, and the biggest selling nonfiction book in the US was The Purpose-Driven Life, by Rick Warren. And the reason that was so compelling for so many people is because there's such a lack of purpose in most people's lives. We know we're here for something better. So you're saying, is there a way to find the why? Well, ask better questions. Most people have no clue how to ask themselves empowering questions. Yeah, and questions direct your focus. Questions direct your thinking. Yeah, it's the way you get to program your own sat nav. And so, ask better questions. When was the last time you sat in front of the mirror, turned off your iPhone, and says, "You know something? What really lights me up? What am I passionate about?" And actually held that level of self-inquiry long enough to get a congruent answer. rather than distract yourself with, you know, what's the latest post on Facebook that nobody cares about. Yeah, it's about asking yourself better questions. Yeah, lead yourself through, because the why is there. Yeah, the heart, I told you earlier, the heart speaks in two tones, yes, no. It will tell you, but it's very faint. You've got to shut the mind up in order to hear it, because the mind is very loud. So if the mind is speaking, you're never going to find your why. You may try and rationalize it. You may come up with some esoteric sounding level of why you think you can justify doing what you're currently doing or something else based upon the fact it balances out on a SWOT analysis. But that's not, you're not going to get close to understanding your truth for that coming from the heart. Now, we all know what lights us up if we sit and think about it long enough. But the other thing I'd encourage people to do is not get caught up in searching for their purpose, because then the mind kicks in again and takes you on a merry-go-round. You know, the analogy I'll give there is if you take a honeybee, for example, you know, and you get a honeybee that is, if you were to ask a honeybee what its purpose in life is, yeah, most likely if a honeybee could understand the question, it would turn around and say, well, my purpose is to make honey. That's what honeybees do. But you and I would know different. You and I, from a higher level of awareness, would know that the real purpose of a honeybee isn't to make honey. The real purpose of a honeybee is to play a vital part in the ecosystem of life at a global scale by pollinating flowers in its, you know, en route to collecting its nectar to make its honey. Now, if you imagine a honeybee sit there to its friend saying, you know something, I just don't think it's this honey thing. I think there's something deeper to my life. I'm going to go and sit here. In fact, I'm going to go and fly up and sit on a mountaintop for a while and figure it out. And I'm not going to collect any more honey or make any more honey until I figure it out. I mean, it's ludicrous. What would happen in that scenario is the real purpose of the honeybee would never get unfolded. So rather than sit there and wonder and beat ourselves up about what is the why, keep moving your feet in the direction of where your heart is telling you you're lit up, and allow it to present itself in a way that may show up. Rather than make it into this big, what am I doing this? Why am I there? That's just a counterbalance to the frustration, the fact that you've been listening to the mind for too long, if that makes sense.
Peter, what you're describing reminds me of the work of Eckhart Tolle. He's a highly acclaimed spiritual leader and teacher.
I call it very well.
Yeah. So I read his Power of Now book, and I resonated strongly with it. And in his case, he also found, I think, his message when he hit bottom. So I remember correctly, he found himself sleeping on a bench park after going through some real tough times. And he asked some deep questions and came back with the answer. And his answer is really the concept of power now is to live in the moment. And I do understand the concept, and I know that suffering has to do with living either in the past or in the future, as far as your thoughts are concerned. But the difficulty, I think, for me, and I probably would say for most people, is to the day-to-day awareness of
Correct.
Being in the moment. I understand the concept. I
yep.
know how important that is. But how do you, for lack of, prevent yourself from falling back into the same old routine? And when I hear an inspirational talk like you just did, how do I keep this on a day-to-day basis as part of my life?
Well, wonderful question, Fernando. And if you'll permit me, I'll share with you what I believe to be my answer. Yeah, and I remind people, I don't have any answers. I only have my answers. And if they're happy to point in those directions that are helpful, then you know that's great. You know, I'm not here, and certainly not at the emotional level I used to be, where I needed to be right in order to feel good about what I'm saying. Yeah, but there's three general ways that I found that will allow people to move forward in that direction. The first is the rarest, and that's what happened to Eckhart Tolle when he was at his rock bottom and he was depressed. He was in bed and he had suicidal thoughts and actually came up with the phrase, you know, I can't live with myself any longer. And then actually his ego dissolved in the understanding of the duality that's revealed in that question of I cannot live with myself, which means if I can't live with myself, there must be two of me. Yeah, and that awareness is what triggered the dissolution of his ego. Now, that is the basis of most high-level spiritual teachers throughout history that have affected people. You know, they have an experience beyond the normal, but that's not available to 99.9% of the population. The other way to do it is immersive experience. Yeah, if you go and become a monk or a Zen master, and I've spent a lot of time with, yeah, living in monasteries with Zen masters and studying the different ways of monks. You know, and I'm certainly not a Zen master, and yeah, my lady will vouch that I'm certainly not a monk. But you know, there is a way to be able to do that if you do a full-on immersive experience. But again, that's not available to most people, which leaves the third way. And the third way is to little and often. You know, we're cybernetic creatures. We're creatures of habit by design. Yeah, it has to be little and often. You will condition yourself because your body and your mind are 24/7 constant giant adaptation machines to external environment or internal environment for thoughts. Yeah, we're all familiar with the concept that if we, you know, as an adaptation machine physically, you know, are constantly 24/7 adapting to our environment. If that environment is McDonald's six times a week, your body's going to adapt to it, trust me. If it's going to the gym six times a week and doing live fresh juices, it's going to adapt to that. If it's sleeping 2 hours a night for a week, you'll adapt to that in a way that burns out your adrenals. If you're sleeping longer, so you get the point. So we're used to the physical aspect where the body will constantly, 24/7, adapt from the day we're born to the day we die to the environment we consistently introduce it to or condition it to. But what most people aren't aware, or they usually forget, is that the mind is exactly the same. You know, if you go to the gym and you've never trained arms and you're trying to lift dumbbells, you're not going to get fit or strong. You're going to get sore. But over time, your body responds and you're going to build your biceps. Yeah. If you are trying to go into a meditation state and get into a theta brainwave state, and all you're normally used to doing is watching TV and doing social media, yeah, you're not going to get to a Zen place. You're going to get to a frustrated place. But if you can do it over time, that's why consistency is so important. You know, I have a morning routine whereby this morning I have a meditation room in my house. I go and quiet my mind. I seek repose. I sit in silence. It conditions the mind for you to be able to control it. Because the challenge is most people identify themselves with their mind and they can't separate that. Whereas it only takes a little bit of self-reflection to understand the truth that, of course, you're not your mind, just as you're not your body. There is a sense of you that's way beyond that, that's far more powerful. Yeah, the you tells the body to move, the body will move. But it's not, you're not your body, because you've got a very different body now to when you were 5 years old or when you're 90 years old, but it's still the same you. It can't be the mind, because you, the sense of you becomes so alive when you're standing on a beach looking at a sunset, holding the hand of somebody you love, and the mind is in complete silence, but you feel alive. So you can't be the mind. That essence of who you are is behind that. And if you can get in touch with that, even if it's for a little time, yeah, even if you're going to the gym and just lifting a couple of weights every day, you're going to respond. So, you know, don't try and pray for instantaneous enlightenment. Yeah, odds are against you. Yeah, and you know, if you want to go and live with the monks and spend 20 years on a mountain, then be my guest. But that's not available to most people that have a family, kids, and a mortgage to pay. But what is available for everybody is to spend a little bit of time every day, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. You know, look up the heart math guys and get into a state of coherence and train yourself. Yeah, get into a state of where you're used to being quiet and turning off the phone, even if it's leaving it at home when you go to a restaurant. Yeah, start to condition yourself so you can unplug on your terms rather than get sucked into life on its terms, which is way too fast moving for most people these days, and stress is usually the result, versus becoming a master of our own thinking.
Peter, one other thing I'd like to ask you, you know, there's some big questions that I think most people have. Why are we here? And what's the purpose of it all? I remember watching a TEDx talk that you had where you described that unbelievable, gruesome week-long marathon you undertook across the Sahara Desert.
And the pictures of the feet, that was bad.
Yeah, don't do it.
Good advice.
But my question is, it seems that something as extreme as that brings you to a place of quietness and self-retrospect that allows you to answer some of these big questions. And I'm curious, did you get to your answer to why are we here and what's the purpose of it all?
Certainly not in the desert, although the question, why am I here, was certainly asked on day two, but it wasn't in context of the bigger picture, trust me. But I've looked at that. You know, I'm a philosopher. I've studied some of the great minds in history, and I've spent many years looking at different levels of questions, existence and evolution, philosophy, theology, religion, spirituality. And so that question obviously is usually the ultimate question. And again, I have an answer, and it's only an answer for me. And what I'm saying and what I'm seeing a lot is that the real purpose of why I feel I'm here is to become the best expression of who I am that I can be. And that is a journey. It's not a destination, as we said earlier. You know, Buddha wasn't born enlightened. He was born Prince Siddhartha, who then became a monk who eventually became Buddha. You know, who are we? If we're becoming better day by day, if we're trying to be a better father, a better athlete, a better person, at whatever level, that's the path of why we're here, to express who we are and walk our truth. Now, I believe the reason I'm here is to walk my truth. Now, my truth can evolve, as hopefully it should do. You know, we don't get to vote on whether we mature physically. That's non-negotiable. Yeah, no matter what the pharmaceutical and the beauty and cosmetic industry will try and tell you. But whether we mature emotionally is a choice. And it's a choice most people forgot that they have. Yeah, so if we can evolve and be committed to walking our truth for whatever that is, your heart will tell you, your mind won't tell you, but your heart will tell you what that is, then to become the best expression through those two laws of nature that I mentioned earlier, to become a better person by growing emotionally, spiritually, physically, etc., and also being able to contribute. Because I'm a great believer that true power, greatness is expressed in your proportion to your willingness to serve beyond yourself. If we can get out of our egotistical what's in it for me and stop walking around, oh, why am I here? Well, what can I get out of life? And start asking the question, what does life want from me? We can start shifting our level of thinking to start getting in touch with the energy of those questions. Will we ever find it? I don't care. I'm happy to live in the space of a question, certainly at that level, and surrender to the fact there's an intelligence that beats my heart and heals my cuts that I can't stop, that is obviously a lot smarter than I am. Yeah, if you want to put it into different levels of context, here's again, and I know, I don't want to take up too much time here, guys, but let me finish on this side. If you imagine asking yourself the question, you're a slug, and you ask yourself, what's the purpose of life? You probably say it's to munch lettuce leaves and leave sticky trails, because that's about it. You go to an ant and you ask an ant, what's the purpose of life? And it says, look at that slug over there. Yeah, what a boring life. No, an ant, the real purpose of life, to be part of a colony, to be part of a team, to have structure, order, hierarchy, all of that stuff, purpose. That's the real meaning of life. Now, the slug has no conceptual understanding of the life of an ant. But as the ant crawls over the toe of a hen, you ask the hen, what's the purpose of life? And the hen looks at the ant and says, look at those, complete autonomous, dealing with pheromones, serving a queen they've never met, all expendable to the bigger cause. Nah, that's not where it's at. Now a hen's where it's at. I get to strut around. I've got freedom of choice, freedom of will. I've got all different aspects of life that I can, strut around be with. Other hens. What a much, much better life. Now, the hen has no conceptual understanding that it's in a poultry farm. It's just awareness isn't big enough, just as the ant has no conceptual understanding of the life of a hen. Now, we have no, we look at the hen and think, hen, lunch. But we have no conceptual understanding of what's the next level above us. It's not because we're not intelligent or smart. The hen thinks it's far smarter than the ant. This thinks it's smarter than the slug. It's just that our base isn't big enough. So if you can surrender to live in the space of a question and say, listen, I don't know what the answers are. Yeah, but I'm not going to get caught up on invalidating my life as a result of that. So if I can come from a place of saying that, I'm just going to live the best life that I can live, be the best person who I can be, and wherever that takes me, I'm sure it's in tune with why I'm here, then it's not a bad deal in my book.
That is very well put. Yeah, very profound, no question. It reminds me of this saying, that human beings are the only beings for whom being is an issue. And you've addressed a lot of these big questions about that today and about other things. So that's just fantastic. And I know we've got to wrap up, but you know, I just wanted to quickly ask you before you go, Peter, about your energy company. I mean, you really get involved in some fascinating businesses, and you've been very successful about that. Can you give us an update before you go?
Well, so certainly, if you're talking about thinking big and how...
That's thinking really big.
Yeah. You know, when I said earlier about the purpose of a goal is, you know, if I have any idea how I can achieve it, it's too small. Well, this qualified. But yeah, it was several years ago I came across the concept of space-based solar, which for those listening that haven't come across it is a validated concept of being able to put solar panels instead of on rooftops where every night it gets dark and therefore energy is intermittent. If you were to put it in orbit where the sun never sets, you can transmit that energy 24/7 like a radio signal, like a cell phone signal back to Earth to provide constant, clean, deliverable energy on demand broadcast anywhere on the planet in real time. And I looked at that, and I'm an entrepreneur, not an engineer, but I understand business cases. And you know, it was an ambitious attempt, and I put an incredible team together. And over several years, we pushed space-based solar as a technology to a point of commercialization, whereby we got several governments involved, and it's now on the energy agendas of places like China, places like Japan, places like India. And I'm very proud of the role that we were able to play in being able to move space-based solar into the 21st century in a way that it's going to be accelerated for its commercialization. Now, as a cherry for ourselves to bite, it was too big. But yeah, you have to be able to partner with a government, I think, at that level. And again, we hosted symposiums in China. We worked extensively with different levels of government representatives, certainly in the US. And we very proudly, as I say, took the baton and pushed that forward. Will it happen in the next 10 years? It'll certainly have a lot more traction than it did. Will we see the first commercial application of space-based solar power in the next 20 years? Yes, absolutely. It's an inevitable technology. There's several futurists, George Friedman being one of them, that thinks that space-based solar will provide majority of the world's energy within the next 50 to 80 years, and it makes sense. And it was, I'm very proud of what I'd be able to do to be able to push that forward. And, you know, I put a lot of my personal fortune into that. And, right now, I'm also focused on being able to put a project, which I'm very proud of, in Rajasthan to build out Indian ground-based traditional solar farms to help, put 250,000 families into a clean energy environment in India. And so really, again, that's where I'm focused on the energy side. But as I said at the beginning, everywhere I look and talk about practice what you preach, my heart tells me for the last 12 months that everything that I'm doing is leading me towards being able to focus more on sharing my message with people and helping. I'm writing a book right now called I Am, The Power of Reinventing Yourself, which will be out in the first quarter of 2015, which is going to be a game changer for understanding life. And I've got a mentorship program, which I work with high-level CEOs on being able to help them shift their consciousness as well as their business. And so that's really my focus right now. But the energy side is certainly something that I'm also passionate about, being able to help people, because goodness knows the world, the country, and the planet need it.
Fantastic. Well, Peter, a very, very interesting. You've got an incredible adventure ahead of you, and incredible story behind you. So keep up the good work and keep doing great things. And thank you for joining us. Fernando, thank you for co-hosting. You were right. Peter's work is phenomenal. I'm glad that we got him on the show.
Oh, one more question, Jason, if you don't mind. I'm sorry for interrupting, but this is kind of an interesting one. Peter, one of your companies is the Worldwide Health Corporation. Do you have any breakthrough anti-aging product that you're coming out with that we can use?
Well, the Worldwide Health Corporation, I founded in 1997. I sold it in 2005. That's it's still going strong. I resold it. It was actually resold it to another big company a couple of years later. But health is one of my passions. And I can tell you that at the cutting edge of the sciences that I spend a lot of time at, everything from the quantum physics, nonlinear dynamics, chaos theory, to advanced theoretical and particle physics is a lot of my passion right now, just to understand the nature of life. in those areas because of what's been happening over the last exponential levels of growth in the last few years, there are so many new and exciting discoveries around aging and anti-aging. What has to happen is that the old guard needs to move out of the way. You know, your traditional pharmaceutical-based model is nothing about, you know, treating symptoms. It's like when people tell me, they say, oh, I'm sick, I'm going to the doctor. I'm like, well, no disrespect, but why would you go to a doctor if you were sick? You know, a doctor's never studied health. You know, if I'm sick, I want to get healthy. I want to go to see to somebody who's studied health. And doctors have never studied health; they've only studied sickness. Now, that's not
doctors are great if you're actually like bleeding.
Yeah,
that's when you go to a doctor.
Yeah, immediate implication for trauma. Pharmaceutical has a very valid place, but you know, doctors is not their fault. They're some of the most kind, generous, considerate, and people that want to help people. That's why they got into the profession. But you know, they're trained, and their training is funded by pharmaceutical companies who are studying sickness and how to maintain and treat symptoms of sickness, not cure anything. So that old guard has to move out of the way. Yeah, if you want health and anti-aging, go talk to somebody who studied it. And again, the with the internet and freedom of information now, there's some very, very exciting stuff that's coming out. I don't want to mention anything specifically here because it's not the place for it. But it doesn't take a lot for you to start looking at different aspects. I was approached twice today by business opportunities looking for funding on clinical trials of stuff that is just off the charts when it comes to treating most degenerative diseases now. We're not far off, guys, from a real revolution in that.
That's great.
I would agree, and I've been studying the longevity stuff for a while now. We're actually launching a new show on that. It's called the Longevity and Biohacking Show. So, Fernando, I'm glad you asked that question before he left us. That's just a fascinating area.
The last thing I'll just leave on with that, guys, is that magic pills, potions, and cures and discoveries are absolutely no substitute for you doing what I said earlier, the little and often day-to-day stuff. Now, if you're getting up and having an espresso versus a live green juice, then you're on a certain track. Yeah, diet, exercise is something you can take charge of in a heartbeat. Yeah, I have a whole straight talk on health and vitality, but from that side, we're still about not substituting ownership of that for ourselves. Yeah, that's personal responsibility is the core of everything we've spoke about this last hour. But again, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Fernando, for the invite. It's been always a pleasure to be able to share, and I hope this has been of some value.
Thanks, Peter.
It's been excellent. Thank you.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn how to finance your next big real estate deal, there's a show for that. If you want to learn more about food storage and the best way to keep those onions from smelling up everything else, there's a show for that. If you honestly want to know more about business ethics, there's a show for that. And if you just want to get away from it all and need to know something about world travel, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.